Welcome to Water Talk. In today's episode, we are revisiting a conversation with David Mas Masumoto. Mas has a third-generation organic farm in Delray, California, where he and his family produce peaches, raisin grapes, nectarines, and apricots. He also is an acclaimed and ethereal author of several books about farming, rural life, peaches, and Japanese-American history, and has actually released a new book called Secret Harvests, A Hidden Story of Separation and the Resilience of a Family Farm. And I actually have this book in my hands, and I'm so excited to read it. And the artwork in the book is gorgeous, too, by Patricia Wakita. And in honor of its release, we just thought it'd be a wonderful idea to just revisit this conversation that we had with him. We talked a lot about water. We talked about farming. We talked about intergenerational farming and the future and thinking of climate. And of course, we did talk about peaches. So without further ado, we would like to welcome all of you and say that we're really excited to go back in time to 2020. So there is some drought talk and revisit this conversation with Mas Masumoto.
Can you tell us a little bit more just about your farm and how you came to farming?
Okay, I was born and raised on this small farm, and our farm is in a little area called Delray, which is just south of Fresno. We started with 40 acres and now have 80 acres. Little quick background, my grandparents immigrated from Japan about 100 years ago. And of course, they were farm workers because they were poor. But then they had alien land laws, which prevented Orientals from owning land. And it was really a racist act targeting Asians and specifically Japanese Americans from owning land. So our family, my parents were born in, you know, the 20s and 30s. And during that Great Depression, the whole dream of the family was to get a farm. And right when they're about ready to pull out of the Depression, World War II came, of course, and the internment of Japanese Americans. I was born after that time. But both my mom's side and my dad's side of the family were uprooted, imprisoned in camps in Arizona. And they spent 4 years behind barbed wire. Amazingly, they gained some strength, came back. And my dad said the only way to make yourself a name for yourself in America was to buy a farm. So he bought a farm, took a big gamble in 1948. And the story that I understand my grandmother told my dad when he told her that we're buying a family farm, my grandfather was all excited and got in the car to leave the little rented shack that they were in. And my grandmother was furious because she said, "You do not take chances in America because they will take things away." And she was absolutely right. She was absolutely right with that. But needless to say, my dad, they went ahead and got the farm and they started it. It was a poor land. It was full of hardpan rocks. So he spent 5 years clearing out hardpan one at a time, just using dynamite to blow up the rocks, load them onto a wagon and get rid of them. And now we have this wonderful farm. I was born and raised on here like good farm kids. I couldn't wait to run away. So I left the farm. I was the youngest. My older brother was an electrical engineer, went to Caltech. My older sister became a nurse. So she left the farm and I was the only, quote, hope for my parents. But I probably broke my dad's heart. I said, I will never come back to the farm. I ran off to Berkeley because I knew it'd be the one campus that my parents would never kind of want to come visit me at. And they never did go to the campus. But probably the turning point happened when I took my junior year abroad and I studied for about 2 years in Japan. And I think that what's turned me around. While I was in Japan, I returned back to the little native village that my grandmother and grandfather had come from, Kumamoto, Japan, which is in the southern part. Kumamoto, in many ways, is like Fresno of California. It's a very rural area. People there are shy about saying that they're from Kumamoto because it means inaka. You're from the countryside. You're like a country hick. And I understood that feeling. I worked on the family farm for about 6 months of my time there learned about a different way of farming and realized that I knew nothing about how to grow rice. It was an alien crop, even though I had eaten it my entire life. And that was one of the turning points. I decided to come back to the farm here. So after Berkeley, I came back, started farming with my dad, ran off, did a little work at UC Davis, came back and started farming. And one of the thoughts I would bring back was, how can we farm sustainably? I guess in a way you could say we're doing regenerative agriculture. And part of that was, how do you look toward the future on a farm? Because I planned on staying on this farm for the rest of my life. So in a fun way, I had, 40, 50, 60 years to figure out how to do this. And so I started farming, got married, had a couple of kids. Our daughter is partnering with me on the farm. And we're still trying to figure out ways to sustain ourselves. But we got very fortunate in that we were early adapters for organic farming. And we sort of rode the crest of all that. And things have worked out very well on just about every level.
When you mentioned what your grandmother said about just taking risks, like, it actually made me think about the water question, right? I mean, you've taken a lot of risks, really, because it being, at the base floor of the organic farming movement, that was a big risk, I'm sure, back then, in that people hadn't figured it out yet. There weren't these guides available for how to manage pests and manage diseases organically. But yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us a little about how, as an organic farmer, that you are managing water at the scale of your whole farm. Like, how are you kind of dealing with allocation and surface versus groundwater?
One of the good and bad things about my education was I studied sociology at Berkeley because I thought it'd be the one major that would never bring me back to farming. Here I am farming. But it did provide two things. On the plus side, it allowed to give me perspective on broader issues other than just farming. On the bad side is I didn't know what I was doing half the time. My agricultural science background is very bad. But what it did lend itself to was two things. One, the idea of always asking questions and always wanting to learn. And the other thing, and I think that fits water today, you can't control that. Most conventional farming is all around the idea of controlling nature, controlling pests, controlling productivity, even trying to control markets. The organic market was wild and continues to be fairly uncontrolled. Certainly farming with all the different pests are always a new chapter every year. And working with water, because, when I began farming in the 80s, it was the end of that golden age where people thought we knew how water patterns are. We knew what rain patterns were. And we were ending it. And it was this really blip where rains were consistent for about 40 to 50 years. Well, that ended just when I started farming. And then drought started hitting. You had these cyclical rhythms of rainy years, good snowpacks, then drought. Then you start looking at tree rings and realize, oh, we're talking about not 2 or 3 year droughts. There are 50 year droughts. And I'm going, okay, I'm, 30. That means it will be a drought till I'm 80. What am I doing here? But the whole idea, though, with water is that you understand and that it's uncontrollable, that it's going to be, you have to just always work with it. And it's not something that works with standard economics, for example, where everything is rational. It's going to be very irrational of what we do.
Now that we've established that kind of water is not controllable, and it's this thing that you are trying to manage as best as you can, though it is uncontrollable. So how do you go about deciding, when your trees and your vines need water, and then how much water to give them?
This is the good or bad things that I do because I didn't have a strong scientific background. I never kind of grasped everything from evapotranspiration rates and water use and all that. I went by the old school of these trees look like they need water. It probably came from, again, this is probably my background as a more of a cultural farmer. Listening to my dad. And he started explaining how, well, when the trees look like this, it looks like you might need the water. One of the things with organic farming is you pay attention to soils a lot. Soils are the lifeblood of organic farming. So I pay attention to soils more than anything else. And they tell me exactly when ground starts drying out, and what can I do? The other part of that was early on, I became very familiar with our ground. We have basically a Hanford sandy loam on most of our farm. Some people will come and say, this looks like sand, and it's really a lot of fine silt powder. I have some friends who farm like in the northern Sacramento County area where it's heavy clay, and I do not know how to work with clay at all. It's totally a different creature. I would call it a different beast. The sandy loam really works well. And even within our farm, we had that old school of, we have small blocks of tree fruit, like a 2-acre block of one variety of peach, a 1-acre block of another, a 4-acre block. So each one of these blocks, I've learned what the soils are underneath those trees. And if it's an early variety, a mid-season, a late season, it's got adapted to the soils quite well. And I've learned how to work with it, especially through the inconsistencies of nature. So we constantly do a lot of experiments, some planned and a lot unplanned, which I think makes for a good scientist. But anyway, so when these droughts hit, like back in the 80s and the 90s, we monitored things a lot and found out certain peach varieties, for example, tolerated the drought. The other thing that we did, which is probably unconventional, is we have old orchards. I planted one of my prize orchards when I was in high school with my dad. It's like 52 years old, and it's one of our best producing orchards. My theory, and we use furrow irrigation, my theory is the root structure in those 50-year-old trees is massive. And I think it tolerates, especially with our organic soils, it tolerates swings in rain and water much better than a fast producing newer variety. One way of looking at it is sort of like newer varieties of tree fruit, for example, are sort of like thoroughbred racehorses, right? You have your exact systems of drip irrigation, the exact amount of fertilizer and fertility, and you get this fantastic production. We're the opposite. We have workhorses that don't produce really well, but they produce fantastic taste. And that's what we're after. And that's why the organic market rewarded that quality of taste. So we will work with these workhorses who, they'll tolerate heat, they'll tolerate drought very well, as long as I keep them happy enough.
They've done studies now with folks like you, and we call it having a calibrated hand. And it turns out that if you have a calibrated hand and you're able to go out and feel the soil and feel the moisture, people can be just as good or better than the sensors.
For us, that sense of touch is so important. And we try to pass that on to our workers, for example, and our markets are designed to reward that quality. So that sense of touch is so important. And literally that's how we manage water too.
Thinking about just how your organic practices may have changed the way that your soils are capturing and holding water. You mentioned sponge. And actually when I teach or when I'm giving a talk, I always use that sponge analogy for soil. And I've never kind of taken it to this organic place, but you're right in that, like, there's certain things that you can do to make a better sponge, right? So I guess I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about, are there any particular practices or do you really think it's like a synergy of stuff? Like, what has led to having such a nice sponge on your farm?
Probably the biggest factor is time. Right, because when we first came, we were sort of organic growing up, partly because pesticides were expensive, required new equipment, and we stayed small. So when we converted to organic, it wasn't that hard. And the soils, I would think, were fairly healthy then. But over the years, you just go ahead and we do a low tillage model. We do not do a no-till. I tried it and it just doesn't work for our system. The massive amount of, you could call them weeds, I call them native grasses, which is kind of nicer, that get plowed in and dissed in throughout the year is I think massive amounts. Plus, of course, with the trees and vines, we shred everything, we disc it in and incorporate them too, and we give them time to slowly be built up. And again, we've been organic from about 40 years. And that's a long time to keep building up soils. We've done some testing, like for organic matter that have gone up, but I don't believe that's for us the best indicator. The best indicator were the health of the trees. The trees seem to tolerate a lot more, for example, the droughts. I remember during some of these really climate change years, you're getting these huge swings in temperatures. So it's not like just 2 or 3 days in the hundreds. We're getting 20 days in the hundreds. And some of that is 110 degrees. And I was just terrified because they often happen in the middle of summer, right when we're harvesting. And I'd be terrified about that. Amazingly, and I think this has to do with the root structures well-developed in good soils, the trees tolerated these wonderfully. I'd be out there every day checking, oh, the fruit's going to get overripe. They're going to start dropping. The ripening tended to slow down during these heat waves, which was great because my body was getting beat up during those heat waves. So it's as if the tree said, it's so hot, we're going to take the afternoon off. Just relax. And the trees and the fruit tended to just accommodate that. So we weren't getting behind. We weren't being frantic with fruit getting soft on us. They were just taking their time to tolerate this heat. And I think it had to do with these amazing root structures that were developed there. And again, a 50-year-old peach tree must have massive root structures. And we have grapevines, too, that we make for raisins. And we have some vines that are 100 years old. The elaborate root structures are so important. And it's something that probably modern day farming isn't paying much attention to because they're usually paying much more attention to the things we could see. And water is a perfect example. We pay attention to the water we could see, not the water we don't see. And probably in California, the most important things are the underground aquifers and the water. I think that's going to be the key to the future.
How long could a peach tree potentially live? Like, what are you just kind of going to let these old orchards continue to produce? Is there, you know, some anecdotal evidence as to how long they might go? Or
no idea, because most old peach trees that were in like someone's backyard, it was just the backyard. They weren't looking at productivity. They were, you know, it was a very isolated case. Sometimes they cared for it. Sometimes they didn't. We're over 50 years. And again, this one variety, it's the one I've written about in Epitaph for a Peach, the book, Suncrest. It's over 50 years old and it's still our flagship variety. It has a huge amount of productivity. The fruit's fantastic tasting. We have a young orchard that was planted when my daughter was born, which is 35 years old, and we call it the young orchard, right? So it's all relative in that sense. The other thing, too, I think when you look at water is what kind of timeline are you measuring things with? You know, we, especially when, in terms of business world, you're measuring in a very short timeline, a couple years, maybe a decade. But our daughter, we often talk about it thinking that, well, maybe we're talking about water in not just a decade, but in literally generations, 20-year cycles. You know, so what's the water going to be like in addition to climate change 40 years from now? You know, I probably won't be here, but then she'll be, in her, 70s and maybe passing on the farm at that point. And what's the water situation going to be there at that point? And with that kind of a timeline, I think it stretches out things and it allows you to start planning on the one hand for the inconsistencies and also learning how to adapt as things evolve and things go on too.
Yeah, that's really interesting to just kind of try to think that far ahead in terms of a generation and a family. And also think that maybe your peach trees might still be around, you know.
I certainly hope so. And then when you look at some policy questions like Sigma and stuff, that's supposed to kick in about 20 years. We'll see how all the politics of that work out. But then my very naive way of looking at that world then, and 20 years, it's going to be the haves versus the have-nots. Those of you who happen to have a farming in a good area are going to be very fortunate. I actually think we are very fortunate in that. And it's those water districts that don't have good water rights. The groundwater isn't good. they're the ones that are going to really be struggling when Sigma gets kicked in on that. You know, again, though, so what's their timeline? Is it 10 years, 20 years you could farm in those areas? And, you know, I feel bad for them, but I don't know what to say. We just happen to be in a good water area. It does make me think, if we were farming in a tougher water area, what would we do? And I really don't know, because I don't know that soil type. I don't know the trees that are planted there. I don't know the management practices. I don't know what your timelines would be at that point too, if you lived on that and worked on that those fields. So in that sense, I guess another way of looking at water, you know, water is this interesting dynamic. On the one hand, we share water. All right, I don't own just the water underneath me. It's part of a larger irrigation district, a part of a larger aquifer, part of a larger river basin. On the other hand, water is all local, and local could be as fine as what's happening underneath my well that I have. That helps define what we're going to look like in about 20 years too.
Right. So I think you kind of touched on my question pretty well about how your relationship with water has changed, you know, in terms of time and how you see it going in the future. What advice do you have for young farmers or I feel like every time I talk to young undergraduates and graduate students, so many of them are interested in becoming like an organic farmer right now. And like, there's this big movement. Like, what advice would you have for them?
One is to plan on being very patient. And the second thing is plan on asking a lot of questions and be willing to explore different things. So a young farmer, learn about maps and not just the maps you can see, but like aquifers, because that could be just magic of how you understand what you're getting into. So part of my advice, getting back to that, or looking at a young farmer, would be to be willing to learn a lot, have some side income too. Have a partner that maybe has a good job, so you could afford you could have some tough years on that, and realize that you're going to need this balance. But if you're in for the long haul and willing to learn a lot, it could actually be pretty fun too. And there's this other side of me too, that I look back and our daughter is very entrepreneurial in that way, looking at ways of innovating all the time. And we've become really good friends with some people in the food world too, that really it's that innovative entrepreneurial spirit that's really fun. So instead of looking at the dread of farming with water or lack of water, it's more like, how would that work? What would that happen? What would happen when you have some peach trees that are limited in water? You know, one simple idea would be, you know, make sure you have early season peaches. Why? Because it's the late season peaches that are going to need the extra water you may not have. You know, that's one of the reasons why we shifted over to some early apricots. Because I never grew apricots growing up, find out that there's a pretty good market for good tasting apricots. So we have this one variety that it will probably fail, but it's okay because we harvest it probably in early May. And if you get some spring rains, we might not even need to irrigate it until post-harvest, which is a very different irrigation pattern on that. So those are those little innovative things you could do that no one really thinks that much about, to how to accommodate and live with different things too. So that ability to, you know, ask questions, learn a lot, be patient, and innovate as much as you can. That would be my advice to a young farmer.
That's wonderful. That's very inspiring too. I like that it's like, don't think of this as doom and gloom. Think of it as just a fantastic, you know, opportunity, and have some, you know, the vision. So I think the side hustle or partner with a stable job, you know, that's very practical.
And it's essential to have that kind of stability, because you're working in a world that's driven by nature. You're working in a world that's driven by especially climate change as it continues to unfold. You're living in a world of inconsistencies with water. So you need to have some stability in your life. And it might be a partner or somebody that you could work with that allows you to live through those instability, through those uneven times, and learn from it.
Right. And I mean, on that note too, like we've been hit by a pandemic, right? I want to acknowledge that at the time that we're recording this, we're in the midst of what is this, the third wave of the pandemic? I think it's the third wave of the pandemic. And I just want to ask, you know, how has the pandemic impacted your day-to-day life and your business?
One of the things the pandemic has shown is the value of human capital. In other words, workers. Workers are essential to what we do. And finally, I think workers are getting some of the respect in terms of that, you know, we have to want them to be healthy. They you know, they want to work, we want them to work. It's all part of this, you know, interesting way, this fragile food system. So on the one hand, you had the importance of workers that are can't be underscored. And it's wonderful to actually be called an essential worker. I thought, hey, I never thought of myself that way. That was nice. But the second thing is the pandemic exposed the delicacies in our food chain. Early on, there are all these questions about, you know, delivery systems. You know, well, farmers might have the milk that they were going to be raising, but they couldn't be bought. They weren't. It was designed to be going. The milk product was designed for food service, which was closing down, and they weren't ready to set up, and the systems weren't ready to set up for grocery stores. And yet, milk was selling out at grocery stores. So that fragility of the food chain really got exposed, and hopefully people learned a lot of lessons from that. And I think that's very, very important. But possibly the most important thing that comes out of this pandemic, people are paying attention to food more than ever. And it partly had to do with someone else isn't making food for them. They're making food for them. They're making food choices. But I think people were beginning to pay attention to food, and with that, pay attention to where food comes from. And with that, I believe a new awareness about what goes into food. And that's where water comes in. I think there's a moment now in that people will be very aware of issues surrounding, you know, resources like labor and water, and how that affects the food chain that we're all part of. So this amazing moment, we all see how things are integrated, ironically, because you have this massive disruption of the system with this pandemic. So I'm very optimistic about that. Oh, yeah, we've worked crazy hard in this last 8-9 months. Our workers were been fantastic. You know, every day, especially during summer harvest, you know, we were saying what's going to happen next. And amazingly, good things happened. Example, we sell some of our produce into a food distribution system where you could do it online. And the online sales were amazing. It's Good Eggs out of San Francisco. And we've been working with them for years. The amazing things about Good Eggs were, one, people were buying peaches online. So they weren't looking at the traditional indicators of quality, which was usually size. So that intrinsic bias of going into a grocery store and thinking big fruit is going to be better than small fruit was wiped out when you bought it in a two-dimensional flat computer screen. So these intrinsic biases that people have were slowly being eroded with this pandemic. So people were buying it. Also, they were getting food delivered and finding out that this system could work. Right. There's certain efficiencies, even though you're paying for a delivery charge and everything, but people could then buy food and sales are going and continue to go fantastic. And I hope some of these trends stay in there, because it shifts some of the food patterns we're at. And again, thinking about how using water is all about innovation. That's what I think the pandemic is forcing. Who are the innovative ones out there that are adapting to these changes?
At the small peach issue is pretty interesting to think. I'm sure I have that bias of, you know, looking for bigger fruits and vegetables. And it's interesting to hear how, like, just the transfer would maybe take that away.
It really makes you understand what kind of implicit and intrinsic biases we carry. And some of it is we just can't help it. And I know when I came back to the farm, there was this huge trend that was evolving with peaches, nectarines, that the redder would be better. So the nurseries got smart to develop fruit that looked red and then also shelf life. So they stayed hard and it was perfect for the grocery store chain. Not perfect to eat, all right? But people were buying with their eyes. They wanted bigger. They wanted redder. They wanted things that were hard and firm. And our job was to try to find out if there's a market that would look the other way, that would be looking at a different way of measuring standards. It's interesting to see, what does it take to grow a bigger peach? Does it take more water? And it's actually, we don't want a watery peach. We want a peach that has intense flavor. So who knows, maybe actually you could have water savings if you grew better tasting produce.
Absolutely. I got to say, this is something I'm researching. I'm working on this in tomatoes, but it'd be interesting to also think about it with peaches, is this kind of like water, flavor, nutrition, how they're all connected. Because it also seems that, you know, with less water comes improved flavor and also could potentially be more nutrition. So yeah, absolutely.
Consumers, if they become more aware of these type of things, maybe it doesn't take much for a tipping point, I don't think. And this pandemic is actually showing that, right? Because people actually are saving money by not going out and eat so much. So as a result, they have a little more disposable income for food. So they're maybe exploring and buying things and realizing, ooh, I could buy that organic stuff. I could buy that heirloom stuff. Why? Because that heirloom, you know, peach dessert that you would have bought at the restaurant for $18 probably cost you about $4 to test at home. And they're going, oh, this is great. So I think it's opening up and developing different markets for that. So things are starting to shift in that sense. So in an ironic way, the pandemic has caused a lot of structural changes. And maybe we were ready for a structural change like that to happen. Same as a drought occur that happens with water. It just demands and forces you to make some changes and adjustments. And those that don't adjust are the ones that get left behind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we always like to ask our guests if there's anything that you want people to know about your work and how can we all support you?
One, there's two ways you can support. One way is, in general, I would love to see more funding, public policy issues around weather and weather forecasting, you know, both short term, but long term, you know, short term, if, you know, the better, you know, satellite imagery we could have, I could plan around that. And long term. And you guys know, as researchers, long term forecasting is pretty much of a crapshoot right now. You know, yeah, they could sort of say this is La Nina year, but what exactly does that mean? And I study your maps that you guys, you scientists make, and I go, look, that line is right at, you know, at Modesto or Sacramento. I think, you know, we're going to be okay or not, you know, but those lines are pretty vague. So I'd love to see a lot of funding, research, and emphasis going to weather forecasting, which helps both farmers, but also urban users too. Because if urban folks in cities can have better forecasting models, they can adjust all kinds of things in their life, not only the short term, you know, can I go out and play golf or tennis or something, but also long-term thinking that, what does this mean in terms of energy use and things like that? The second thing, and this is probably why I ended up writing, there's power in story and storytelling. And we live with stories all around us. Sometimes we know it, sometimes, and a lot of times we don't. Like our bias about big fruit, for example. We have that story that's embedded in our mind, and we just often sometimes don't listen that's what's happening. So storytelling, I think, is really important. And I think, you know, again, thinking about what's the story of water. You know, and then you go, oh, well, water, it's, you know, rainfall in the Sierras and the snowmelt. Well, how about the water we can't see in the aquifers? What is that story? How do you tell that story? And that sometimes comes into questions about like mapping and graphics and illustrations, because a good story, a good map could frame how we start talking about something.
Thank you for listening to the Water Talk podcast. My name is Samuel Sandoval, I'm a professor and cooperative extension specialist at UC Davis.
I'm Faith Kearns with the California Institute for Water Resources in the UC Division of Ag and Natural Resources.
I'm Malika Noko, an assistant professor of soil-plant-water relations and irrigation management at the University of California, Davis. If you enjoy our show, please review, listen, like, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Find transcripts and additional content at watertalkpodcast.com. Original music by Paloma Herrera-Thomas.